Welcome to Midweek Mysticism. It is, as always, a great pleasure and honor to study the Zohar together with you all. We are in the midst of a discussion of the 14 preliminary Pikudin mitzvot, commandments, something in the Zohar. It is again worth noting that in distinction to Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, these 14 things are some of them theological, but most of them mitzvot, actual things. And so the Zohar is not giving a series of things you must think, but rather a series of priority within the mitzvot or commandments, and creating a class of super mitzvot or first order mitzvot, which are more important to the system than other mitzvot, which is a different way of thinking about first things altogether. It is more action centered. Now, of course, when the Zohar does it, it's not only interested in the mitzvot, but it's interested in the mystical effect of those mitzvot. And so, it's not just a different list than Maimonides. It's actually, it's got a whole different system. Okay. We're in circumcision now. And actually, I think we might all agree that circumcision, at least internally in the Jewish system, places itself as a kind of higher order. It has a higher ontological importance than other commandments because it's an ot brit. It is the sign of a covenant. And the covenant is Abraham's covenant with God, which, and Abraham is the first Jewish person. And so it's the foundational aspect of being Jewish. It's kind of interesting that actually then it's number 8 in the Zohar's list, you know, and we started with awe and unity, things that were rightly more universal. And we're now moving from universal things that, you know, could have been sent by a Sufi mystic or a Hindu mystic to, meaning they wouldn't have necessarily been, but they weren't particularly Jewish, to things that very much relate to Jews and the people Israel and the destiny of Israel in this system. You're going to see today that gets supercharged and even controversial. Okay. The other thing I'll say is we'll probably see today some of the Zohar's ideas that are going to draw some more, at least for me, there was a lot more opposition in reading them. Some of the ideas become more problematic or controversial. So we'll get into that today as well. Some more difficult ideas. You know, to date, everything has been, you know, take it, leave it. It's an inspiring mystical take. But now we'll get into things that really rub against modern sensibilities in ways that will probably be offensive. So just a warning, we're going there. Okay. But before we do that, I thought that we might want to read an account that the Zohar is going to be assuming or presuming our knowledge of in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. So I thought we'd read it there. So we're now in the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. What is the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer? According to Sfaria, is a midrash that retells and expands upon the stories of the Torah from the creation of the world through the story of Miriam's leprosy. It incorporates discussion on topics like redemption, Messiah, and calculating the end of days. Traditionally considered to have been authored by Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus in the time period of the Mishnah, 1st and 2nd century CE, the work was likely edited in the 8th or 9th centuries. So that's at the very edge and end of the, really in the Gaonic period. All right, it's okay. Silences. My phone is hooked up to my head. All right, it's off now.
Is this considered on the order of like Bereishit Rabbah or any of the other like kind of major Midrashim that you might see quoted just in a standard Chumash?
I mean, it's not as early, but Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer is certainly a major collection. And I mean, I'm not the expert, but it's certainly Miss Chassidim love to quote it. Kabbalists love to quote it. It's certainly because of its topics, Messiah, end of days, and that kind of thing, which is a frequent theme. It is frequently turned to by those interested in those themes. But it's well within the Jewish canon. You know, it's not an obscure midrash, I would say. And so here, let's just get to, this story. So, we're discussing Milah. And here's the story. Va'amar Eliyahu zachor letov v'kana kina gedola v'nishpal shema ala shemayim shelolo rital matara aretz. So what happened? Elijah came and he became very zealous and he swore heaven not to have dew and rain come on the earth. He prescribed, he said, no rain, God, which is a big problem. Normally, you don't want your prophet imploring God to punish the people, that you want your prophet doing the opposite, ideally. But Elijah is Elijah. Zachor letov. Shamai Zevel. And Queen Jezebel heard that this prophet Elijah was bringing destruction upon her kingdom, the great evil Jezebel. And decided that she wanted to kill Elijah. So Elijah got up to pray to God. Carry on the story. Amar lo Yaakov. Param Paro bikesh larog et Moshe, barach mi lepanav v'nimlatz, shenemar v'yivrach Moshe mipnei Paro, Shaul bikesh larog et David, barach mi lepanav v'nimlatz, shenemar v'David barach nimlatz, melamedcha shekol mishu boreach nimlatz. Right, so here the story that happens is Elijah prays, you know, Queen Jezebel's trying to kill me, help. And God basically says, okay, you know, it's a long history of your forerunners being chased by their enemies. Yaakov had to run away from Esau, as we've read, and Moshe had to run away from Paro all the way to Midian. And I miss anything? Shaul and David, you know. So run, you know. The righteous thing to do here is to flee. Look at all of your predecessors; they run. So Eliyahu said, fine, out of here. Got it. This is my holy lot to flee for my life. It's a privilege. I misunderstood God. I thought I should ask you to not do it, but I'll run. He got up. Kano kaniti amar lo kadosh baruch li olam atame kanik kinat bashitim al giloy ariot shenemar pinchas ben elazar ben aaron kain aharon hakohen ekan atame kanech chayacha she'in esha osim brit mila ad she'ataro e be'einecha. So I'll just read this in its full translation here. Okay, so he runs away. And he went to Har Chorev. And he arose and did eat and drink. There the Holy One, blessed be he, was revealed unto him, and he said to him, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" He answered him, saying, "I've been very zealous." He said to him, "Thou art always zealous." You're always zealous, Elijah. You were zealous when it came to the episode with Pinchas. Now, was Elijah at the episode with Pinchas?
Elijah was Pinhas.
Great. So here the Midrash is assuming already this, I think, common interpretation that Pinchas was a, because of his zealousy, was a reincarnation of Elijah, the prophet. It's just presumed here. And you're being, but here it's a kind of funny thing to have a reincarnation of you live before you, just to name. But Elijah, of course, is like a primordial figure, right? And so he's the harbinger of the Messiah. And so he exists before he existed, if that makes sense. Here too, by your life, there's a kind of parallel swearing, right? Just like he swore God, so Chayecha, God is now swearing him that they, the Jews, what was the reason that he was upset in the first place? I should have mentioned this. It's a long back and forth, but basically the reason is that they weren't doing Brit Milah. And so he,
Is
yeah.
that from the Tanakh text that we have, or is that an added interpretation here in the Midrash?
Good question. I should know.
I think from my memory, he's zealous about the Brit covenant, and I think it's the Midrashic overlay that that becomes the Brit Milah. I don't think in Kings it refers directly to the Brit Milah. And of course, the word zealous, kano kaneti, appears in Pinchas' story because he is the zealous one who kills the couple. And I don't know if it appears with any other characters except for God. That would be interesting, but then it reappears with that same word with Elijah. So I think that's another linguistic way that the Midrashic connection of Pinchas with Elijah is made.
Here all it says in the Midrash is Umachut Ephraim Manuma Hemet Amila, right? That the kingdom of Ephraim, the northern kingdom, withheld the circumcision ceremony, but it doesn't quote a text. So I think that's the Midrash, as Rabbi Confer noted, expanding on Elijah's, you know, they're not observing the covenant, and which covenant precisely? Mila. So, you know, I mean, I could ask what's the conclusion of the story here where God says, you know, because you were zealous about Milah, you're always going to see every time they do Milah, you're always going to be there. Ein Yisrael osin brit Milah ad she'ata ro'eh be'enecha. It almost like a new rule. Milah can't happen unless you are present. New, new prerequisite.
It seems intuitively sensible, like if you're that zealous about it, you're going to be sort of the guardian angel of this ceremony.
Do we all agree with that frame? Elijah is kind of appointed by God in reward for his zealousy as the. Now, it is worth noting that Pinchas, in that parallel story, gets the Briti Shalom, my covenant of peace. So it may also be playing on the idea that when you're zealous, you get rewarded with some kind of covenant. There is the covenant of peace, which is kind of ironic for someone who kills people. And here it's the covenant of circumcision. So to the Zohar just needs us to know that before this passage. You need to know that Midrash. Okay, now we know it. Okay. I'll start from the seventh commandment to circumcise, even though we did a little bit of this last time. On the eighth day, removing the filth of the foreskin. For the living being is the eighth of all rungs. Did we do this at the beginning last time? We did, right? Living being is the eighth of all rungs. And the soul that is flown from her should appear before her on the eighth day, since she is the eighth rung. Let me reread that. The soul that is flown from her, from Bina Ima in the Ari's language of Kabbalah, mom or mother, should appear before her, before the Shekhinah, before Malchut, on the eighth day, since she is the eighth rung. If you count down eight from Bina, and so every day becomes part of the descent down of this holy soul, which we've been talking about in prior teachings, right? Actions on earth generating the descent of holiness above, represented in the creation story by birds flying above the Aretz, the Ophi Ofeth Apane Rikiasha, am I right? Is that it? Yeah, birds flying above. So murmuring below, whatever that is, Torah study or sex or different things, causing souls to fly above. So here, it's not just below and above, but it's a link, right? We're closing that circle and bringing the soul down in an 8-day ceremony, if you're following the chain of these commandments. Then it is clearly seen that she is nefesh chaya, a soul of a living being. And by the way, that means a link between nefesh and chaya. Nefesh being the most earthly soul and chaya being the highest soul. In the nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya yechida hierarchy, chaya becomes a kind of tag for chaya yechida. Because once you're yechida, a unity, you're not really a soul anymore. So nefesh chaya is a short buzz for nefesh ruach neshama chaya. The Zohar understands every time in the Bible it says nefesh chaya, it means nefesh ruach neshama chaya, the link between the highest soul and the most earthly soul. Not from the other side, right? Because, you know, you could have something manifest here which begins to draw energy from demonic forces, always empowered by God, yes, but corruptions of divine emanation. That's always the fear, is that if you don't unify above, as we said in the Yichud about the Shema in, I don't know, commandment, something or other, you have to unify above before you can unify below. Remember that. So you know, you could wind up drawing your energy from dark sources here. Think Voldemort, always. Right, you know, you could wind up playing with dark arts in this mystical business. This is let the waters swarm. In the book of Enoch, or Chanoch, let the water of the holy blessed seed be inscribed with the mark of Nefesh Chaya, soul of the living being. This is the mark of the letter Yud, inscribed in the holy flesh, in preference to all other marks of the world. So, very visibly, they imagine, and Rabbi Comfort described a little bit about this last time, Britcha Shechatamta Bibsarinu, the covenant that is inscribed in your flesh. They imagine the circumcision ceremony to be more or less equivalent to creating the letter Yud, to writing the letter Yud out of the phallus. It's a circumcision is an effort to write the divine name on the person. But why Yud? Yud is the start of it all, or the start of emanation, the beginning of God's descent to relate to us. And by writing Yud, we are becoming literally B'Tselem Elohim. Here, you follow. And taking the male sex organ and writing Yud on it is a way of linking that to God's creative emanation and saying people are going to create new life and things. So it is a very charged version of this Brit Milah, but people could do that in demonic darkness, or they could do it in covenantal relationship. Another way of saying it is that even sexual activity could be sinful and dark, and in their mind that might mean self-centered in some way. Or it could be deeply relational, the beginning of a person's deep relation with the other, which is, of course, that mysteriously difficult thing God is doing by creating and emanating altogether, beginning to relate to another in reality, something real. And so they're tapping into the deepest question of the Zohar: how is it that anything exists? And what is the relationship between that which does seem to exist and God? They mean all of that by saying this is the mark of the letter Yud. It's a very loaded phrase, inscribed in the holy flesh in preference to all other marks of the world. But this is the most important thing. It's the highest order thing. It's the first letter of the divine name. Karen, were you going to say something?
Well, I think what you just said answered it. I was going to ask about how this inscription is happening when actually the Brit Milah is a removal. But when you said inscribed in the holy flesh, somehow I thought it was about the incision itself. Because at first I was thinking, let the water of the holy sea be inscribed with the mark of Nefesh Haya. I thought maybe that's the water of the holy sea is sperm, but it's not like it would be.
No, I mean, it might be. Okay, so you've hit on something actually important, which is, yes, we're writing the letter Yud, but we're removing something. And the Zohar imagines that what we're removing are great sea monsters, mythical sea monsters. So, yeah. So let's just imagine for the moment that foreskin are really mythical sea monsters, Poseidon and whatnot. I was recently studying Zohar with someone, and we were dealing with a similar passage, and he just exclaimed, "What were they on?" And yeah. Anyway, some amount of sympathy with that assessment. This hits at something which academics have written many papers on, the Gnostic element in the Zohar. That is to say, here we're touching up against it. I am not an academic. I just breeze through academic articles so that I can refer you to broad themes that occur in the literature. And the Zohar, actually, this last week's Parsha is the main source of the Zohar's most Gnostic, you know, this sort of primordial evil versus primordial good. Do we start with a notion of a good God who creates, but evil is in the realm of human? Or no, are there these kind of deep forces in evil and good, which, you know, we tend to think of as Persians or Zoroastrian, et cetera, and not, you know, Jewish monotheism is in opposition to this notion of kind of evil and good. But the truth is, we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls that at least in ancient Israel, traditions of the sons of light and the sons of darkness in a primordial battle of good versus evil also were quite alive in ancient Israel, and particularly in ascetic and mystical schools in ancient Israel. You know, if anyone's ever read the Dead Sea Scrolls, maybe we'll do that after we finish the Zohar. I took a graduate course in college, two of them. It's remarkable. We read most of the scrolls. And so, a lot about, from that community at least, about sons of light and darkness. So how do you fit one in the other, right? You know, if you have a situation where God is first and the first order thing, how do you fit a kind of Gnostic sense of evil and good? So the question basically relates to you know, all of it's a hedge, but how deeply do you root evil in the Godhead? How far back does it go? Does it start with us or does it start much earlier? And in the Zohar, it's kind of presumed as existing very early on ontologically. The kings of Edom from this past week's Parsha become the primary frame for that in several passages, because it says, Lifnei Moloch Melech B'Yisrael, before there was a king in Israel. So, you know, the biblical scholars use this as proof of the Bible's own non-self-awareness, like it didn't intend to, it seems fine with the idea that it's written later by later people, because it says before there was a king in it. But the way the Zohar deals with that question is to say, no, it's not, you know, it's not some kind of biblical critical piece. It's a mystical teaching. And the mystical teaching is that before there was a king in Israel, that is to say that before God was able to create the world, there were already demonic powers that arose, and they were the kings of Edom. So they're the earliest, and that's before God could create even the Sfirot. So before God could even get to creating the Sfirot, there was evil. So evil pre-exists even God's own projection of God. That's how deep it goes, according to the Zohar. So I think you need that frame to understand that when Elijah is dealing with Izebel, they view this as a battle of good versus evil, or Pinchas, Zimri and Cusby and whatnot. These are primordial battles of evil, often related to sexuality in the case of Izebel and Zimri and Cusby, you know, a kind of hedonism versus that go way back, even further back than the serpent and Eve.
Well, you may get a hint of that in the opening of Breishit, Choshech al Pnei Tahom. And I think some modern biblical scholars like Israel Knoll think that that's part of the ancient Near Eastern image of evil even before creation. So that whole notion may actually go further back, you know, culturally, historically, to the very beginnings of biblical, I don't know, thinking mythology.
That's fascinating. You know, it's just like the ancient Near Eastern worldview presumed they're not even good and evil, but just kind of a primordial state of evil and chaos. Tohu v'bohu v'choshech al pnei tahom. And of course, the Zohar reads Tohu and Bohu as particular demons. But that's just a mystical, you know, an expansion on that idea, right? So this may be very deep in our DNA, I think, is the suggestion here. And so it will take on different expressions throughout Jewish history, but it's going to be hard to excise that for a plain monotheism. And so this all gets to Karen's point. We are removing. We're not just writing, which gets to the point that it's not, you know, God can only manifest by removing evil. And so just as we are in a battle versus evil, God in his earliest letter is already in a battle with the kings of Edom in another version of the Zohar to exist, right? In other words, God has enemies and they're hard to vanquish just to become God. And so too, we have enemies to become in the image of God just to exist. And here those enemies are sexual temptation. They're named. And everything that inherent with that psychologically. Let the birds fly above the earth. This is Elijah. So who are in this new metaphor? The Yishritzu Hashemayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya. We're going back to that. Let the waters murmur. You know, so Karen again alludes to the sperm, which it might have been already in a prior teaching about procreation. But here in particular, Yishritzu Hashemayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya. Remember, Yishritzu might be Yitrash Shemun, which sounds audibly, and we'll get this again soon. There's an audible component. Here it means mark, Yishritzu, mark down below, circumcise down below, remove what is evil down below. And when you remove the evil blockage down below, it allows for flow from above in a kind of projective mirror when we can create and when we are able to project and create in the world with goodness and not evil blocking it, then God's flow is opened up in a parallel and we benefit from that. So there's a horizontal and vertical action occurring here. And when that happens and we are able to be circumcised, then then birds fly above the earth. Who are the birds now? Now the birds are not a holy soul descending, but it is Elijah the prophet who's flying above at the circumcision, who sweeps through the entire world and four guys to be present at that holy circumcision. One must prepare a chair for him and declare, this is a chair of Elijah. If not, he does not abide there. Now, this becomes very influential because as soon as this becomes popular, the liturgy for the Brit Milah ceremony is amended. You don't get it before the Zohar, but you get it a whole lot 50 years after. And suddenly everyone, I don't know of any tradition, Reform, conservative, non-denominational, Orthodox, Litvish, Hasidic, whatever, where they don't say, Zekise Eliyahu Zachor Leto. This is the chair of Elijah. May he, his memory be for good, right? Anyone at every circumcision I've ever been to, they say that because of this. So let's just get into that for a moment. You've got to say that the chair, Elijah is flying. So why does he need a chair exactly? And why do we have to declare the chair? And if we don't say that this is the chair, then he's not there. What's going on with this whole chair ritual? I'm particularly interested in it because it's something we do. We do this. The next baby boy scheduled to be born in our synagogue is due in January. Please, God, it should go well. So at the bris, they're going to say this. I'd like to know why we're doing this when someone asks. Help me.
So this is not a question you're going to answer with text, but rather you're asking for possibilities.
Oh, yeah, I'm just trying to open up some discussion here about if Elijah is flying, what does the chair represent?
I can riff. One possibility is that when you're flying, you're not actually stable. The chair creates a sort of container for that energy to stabilize it on the earth.
So Elijah in the mystical, okay, good. I'm going to play off that and say, I'm going to just, oh, do you want to see more? Please say more.
I have a Torah text to connect it to, which is when it's the throne with the sapphire bricks under it. I think it's just before Kitusa, going up to the throne of heaven. And visiting God and eating and drinking, but God is on a throne, I think, in that passage. Somebody else can, I'm sure, fill in more details. But I'm thinking about, again, there being a chair for God.
So in the Heichalot literature, and Peter Schaefer is the academic who has written all the articles on this, if you want to look them up. Peter Schaefer is his name. The Heichalot school was the early mystical school. Great debates about how early. Does it go back all the way to the Mishnaic times? And are they legitimately texts and traditions from Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael and whatnot, whose ascents are even referenced in the Talmud and Brachot briefly? Or are they a little later? From the Palestinian context and the Amoraic period of the early centuries. One thing I will say, I'm preparing a series. I've been preparing it for 3 years. It's going to probably not happen for another decade. But on the influences of the Heichalot on our prayer liturgy and practice, it's even more than the Zohar is adding a thing here or there, you know, a line here, a new sentence there. But most of the basic structures and prayers are directly from the Heichalot with mystical suggestions from the earlier mystical schools about why you would recite the Kedusha in Shacharit or recite it in the repetition of the Amidah, include Aleinu L'Shabeach at the end. And most of these prayers, El Adon or Aleinu L'Shabeach or Kedusha, etc., a Kaddish even, are directly are poems in the Hechalot school, and they come out of that place. So, like most of our prayer service is a Hechalot based. I think it's the main frame for our actual liturgy, and it's the thing people know the least about. Because if you think the Zohar is cryptic, the Hechalot stuff is just out of control. So only academics, I think, look at it. But the German Hasidim in the Hasidei Ashkenaz and were very influenced by it, and you see it in their poetry and Shir HaYichud and other things from that school. And also the Zoharic mystics, some people have written on it. Ronit Meiroz has written on this. Seem fairly influenced by the Hechalot school, even though they don't quote it directly. And here we're getting that. There is a book of Chanuch in the Hechalot literature. It's one of the major works. And the main theme of that book, sometimes called like Third Hechalot, it has a bunch of different names, but the main theme is Elijah's ascent to heaven to become the angel Metatron. And we've experienced the angel Metatron before. Sar HaPanim, he's called in the Zohar, the Prince of the Faces. And he's the highest angel of God, parallel even to like Bina or something like that. He's a very high up in the Godhead as a kind of compendium angel. And so Elijah is this angel from which the soul is descending at the beginning. Does that make sense? Like Elijah is there flying at the highest places of the Godhead, according to the Hechalot schools. And Elijah has a kind of lower emanation, angel Sandalphon. And I wonder if it's related to sandal being foot or like shoe. I don't know if the etymology is that, but it could be. Who's the Shekhinah equivalent, or like the earthly manifestation of Elijah. And so what you get in the Brit Milah ceremony is effectively Elijah flying high above, and the possibility of a very holy soul for this person flying high above, rooted in the Godhead. And like Karen's saying, you need to instantiate that. You need to create some way for Elijah, the bird flying up. You need to make a bird feeder. You need to get God or Elijah, the prophet who's ascended highest as possible with the soul, to come down so that the soul can get into the person. And then you need to kind of trap that soul with Sandalphon, Elijah's lower angel. And so you get, or supposed to get, this chair of Elijah. And you're supposed to get next to it the Sandak sitting in a different chair. The Sandak is Kisei Shel Sandalphon. It's an acronym. And interestingly, when you Google this, you'll get a lot of Japanese anime series focused on Metatron and Sandalphon. For some reason, like there's a lot of anime that's been created surrounding this drama, which I think is really interesting. It's like people talk about Koreans studying Talmud. I think Japanese anime and the drama between Elijah and Sandalphon and Metatron is also equally interesting. And so you're supposed to get some kind of transfer of the soul from above through or via Elijah the prophet through the Sandak, who is an earthly manifestation of the angel Sandalphon, into the baby. And so the Sandak is a conduit for a holy soul that is going to become inscribed in the baby at the moment of circumcision, which is why we have a special person to hold the baby all together. You could just put the baby on a table and strap them down. Okay. So that's what's going on in the mystical imagination during the circumcision ceremony, which is why we have all of these things. But if you don't do that, claims the Zohar, this doesn't happen. And so the proper performative pieces, but not just performative pieces, you imagine they actually want the kavanot to go with it in the Zohar, right? They've always wanted that. So you kind of have to know this for it to work. I think about this because, my family was close with the Masons. Jackie Mason, the comedian, and I think he and his brother, who are both Moels, is that did all the brises in our family because they were friends with my grandfather. And just like all these mystical things, and we probably had like schlocky stand-up comedy at our brises. Anyway, corned beef. Okay. Enough about me. God created the great sea monsters. Two, foreskin and uncovering, cutting the foreskin and afterward uncovering, they're male and female. So as we know, just like there's a kind of male angel and a female angel, Elijah and Sandalphon, just like there's a male god and a female god, you know, kind of Tiferet and Shekhinah, just like there's Yud and He or Vav and He, there's male and female, right and left, top and bottom. There's Lilith and Samael. There's even male and female demons. There's also, now we move on. What happens next? Ve'evra Elohim et tani nima gedolim in the Bereshit story. God created the great sea monsters. Who are the great sea monsters? They are foreskin and uncovering. It's a little weird. One sea monster is the foreskin and one is the, it's an action, the uncovering of the foreskin. Because the Talmud imagines that there are two requirements of the Brit Milah ceremony. There's the actual cutting of the foreskin, but then one has to pull it back. Yes, the Priah, which is an absolute requirement of circumcision. If one just cuts but does not do the Priah, then the circumcision is not a circumcision. And so they imagine, now what do those correspond to? They correspond to male and female. It's a little weird to be talking about male and female within the penis, but that's where we are. So you'll note that, you know, even within this kind of clearly masculine object, the Zohar is imagining both masculine and feminine energy and masculine and feminine demonic energy. Even male sexuality has female components to it and et cetera in the Zohar. And so even though it's extremely gendered, it's also extremely complex. And by cutting these back, you are removing these sea monsters. Because remember, these sea monsters are in the sea. And the thing we're doing with the circumcision is Yishritsu Amayim, the fish. But the fish might get eaten by the sea monster in our myth. So when the sea monsters go to eat the fish, it's really the demons or sexual energy coming to corrupt the flow of divinity into the creative human process. And we need to kill the sea monsters in order to be able to do that. And so when we cut and uncover the foreskin, we are killing the male and female sea monster couple. Now, which of these is male and which of these is female? As the Mat notes, the commentators are confused. So there's two versions of it, one where the cutting is the female and the removal is the male and vice versa. But I don't know if anyone has, I don't know if we need to get into that per se. Just note, you know, comment, and the mystical commentators are as confused as the academics about which monster is which part. Okay. And every soul of the living being that moves. Maybe we should open Bereshit for a moment. Hold on, just so you see it in the flow. So we figure out where we are here. Okay, so we got stuck for a while on Yishritsu Mayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya and developed many commandments from there. And then, right after, well, the Zohar is very curious by why does God create sea monsters next? But if this is talking about circumcision, it makes sense. Just sea monsters are the things that need to be removed in the circumcision. The great crocodiles. We call nefesh achaya romesas asir shartzu amayim lemineim. We call of kanaf lemineu ve'ar Elohim kitov. So the next thing God does is, after the crocodiles, is call nefesh achaya, the soul of every wild animal that creeps Asher Sharatsu Amayim Liminehem. It called Ov Kanaf Liminehu. Okay, so that's where we are. So back to the Zohar. And the soul of every living being that moves. Inscription of the sign of the Holy Covenant. What is every soul of the living being that moves? It called Nefesh Achaya Romeset Ala Aretz. Inscription of the sign of the Holy Covenant, indicating that she is the soul of the holy living being, as we have said. In other words, now that this is done and these sea monsters have been slain or removed, the living being, that is the person, Nefesh Chaya, right? So they've got the holy soul because they did the circumcision. She is the soul of the holy living being. I think by adding Haromeset ala Aretz, it implies that now the person is, what the Zohar is adding to the commentary of the Pasuk, is that the person is now free to act in the world in a way that won't empower darkness, right? A person has set themselves up, kind of like well-practiced to do good. Which the water brought forth in swarms, which is the next part of the verse. So the Zohar tells us the story. The upper waters were drawn toward this inscribed sign. As we've said, right, the upper waters from Bina were drawn down towards this inscribed sign, the Brit. Consequently, Israel is inscribed with the holy pure mark below. Just as they're inscribed to distinguish between the holy side and the other side of impurity, so Israel is inscribed to distinguish between holiness and other nations, driving from the other side, impure side, as explained. As he marks them, so he marks off their animals and birds and the animals and birds of other nations. Happy is their share. And so the Zohar concludes by saying, this is the point of Israel, which is now entering into the 14 commandments in a very strong way. The point of Israel, and circumcision is the delineating mark between universalism and Jewish in this version of it, is the Zohar's next big idea for us. The main point of being Jewish is to distinguish between that which is pure or impure, or an ability to use spiritual powers in ways that are not confused or marred by demonic powers. So it's not monotheism, but the vanquishing of the demonic is the main special superpower of the Israelites. And that's symbolized by the Brit Milah, which symbolizes the vanquishing of the great sea monsters. And by the way, this symbol repeats itself in all Jewish life, as the Zohar says, you know, Jews versus Gentiles, kosher animals and not kosher animals, kosher birds and unkosher birds. So now in this commandment of circumcision, we actually understand kosher also is included in this kashrut. And also like everything about being Jewish. Doing Jewish, all of Hillel is included in this commandment, do Jewish. So the Zohar's version of do Jewish would be vanquish demons and channel uncorrupted divinity. Do Jewish. Happy is their share. And that's a really exciting place to be. You see an earthly version of this in the thought of Rav Kook. Rav Kook was very much influenced by the possibility that Israel as a geography was a place of spiritual transcendence, which lacked the obscurity of other countries and physical locations in prophecy. You have to imagine he was influenced by this sort of thinking or this very passage. Now,
isn't it kind of parallel to Havdalah ben Yisrael, you know?
The Zohar has a whole to-do about Havdalah. It loves Havdalah. When we get to that, I remember where that part is. It's got a massive passage about the Atachonantanu prayer. It loves the Atachonantanu prayer. Saturday night Havdalah prayer in the Amidah. But this leads us to the next question, because the Zohar is always adding the... Wait a second. So if God did all of this for Israel, what about everyone else? Why are they there? why are they created? But more importantly, can't you convert? You know? And what's our relationship to conversion? Are we proselytes? Do we want to proselytize that everyone should join us? It kind of sounds like it from this. We don't want to just do our thing, live and let live, if this is true. We want to, or even if we're not responsible to save other people, we should really openly welcome people who want to join. Cesar says, that's right. The eighth commandment, to love the convert. You see, that's why what's next. You've got to love the convert. Coming to circumcise himself. Because this person is joining not because of the genetic inheritance or the lineage inheritance, but on their own, to enter beneath the wings of the Shekhinah, to come up, which is a borrowing from Ruth. Now, here the Zohar says, under her wings, she brings those separating themselves from the impure other side and approaching her. As it is written, let the earth bring forth nefesh chaya, souls of the living being, liminehem, according to their kind. What's the liminehem? Liminehem means that there are some other kinds that are not part of this kind that are going to come and join this. There's a variety of kinds. There's Israel, but then there's liminehem, there's plural Jews, if we're reading this as Jews. So wait, who are all these Jews, these types of Jews? The types of Jews are the many different people that will join. But you also imagine that the Zohar is inviting lots of people who were not prior let into the mystical fraternity in. It's not just about conversion per se, but even intra-Israel, perhaps. I've heard this suggested. The Zohar is kind of suggesting a conversion within the Jewish people from non-mystic to mystic. And you get talk about Hasidic conversion, so to speak, in the later Hasidic movement. But the plain understanding here is that liminehem, that others of a different kind will come and join this kind. But there's a problem, just so you understand. It's beneath the wings of the Shekhinah. So the Zohar understands that this soul, and we're going to get on this in a little bit, comes and joins the kind of corporate body of Israel represented in the God, the image of God. But they only will ever occupy the lowest rung, so to speak. There's a kind of, there's still a caste system that is in place for Jews by choice in the Zohar. And I think this might be one of the harder ideas to swallow, that someone that chooses to be Jewish will be rooted under the Shekhinah, and that's phenomenal, and you should learn it, and it's this great thing, and great. And yet there's a limit to how high in the trunk of the tree of life that will go, because it's coming on its own, and not, it's missing the Elijah ceremony. Now, if you say that the soul of the living being contained in Israel is designated for everyone who said that, that the soul of the living being contained in Israel is designated for everyone, that everyone has this holy soul. The Christians said that, or at least some early schools of Christians, and then ultimately Christianity writ large. Now, if you say that someone is different, if you're a Christian, says the Zohar without saying it, to the Christians, we say, well, the verse continues, according to their kind. How many rooms and parts, one within the other, are located in this earth? The living being beneath her wings. Her right wing includes two parlors branching from it. These are big wings. If you think it's just wings you're under and it's like not so good, well, here's what we say to you, Christians. These are big wings. In other words, there's a lot of rooms and parlors in the wings, a lot of space. Her right wing includes two parlors branching from it for two other nations closely related to Israel to bring them into these parlors. Who are these two other nations in the right wing of the Shekhinah bird? And here we're playing with the bird imagery again. Well, they're Esav and Yishmael. They're the two lineal descendants who weren't quite, who branched off. And so the Zohar is saying, yeah, you're welcome to convert. You have a special place if you convert. So it is saying to the Christians who think everyone should convert to Christianity, be no, convert to being Jewish. And the same to Islam. This, by the way, is referenced in the teaching in Lecha Dodi, Yaminus Multi Froti Vieta Shem Ta'aritzi, which is understood by Reuven Kimmelman, the great student of Heschel and expert on liturgy, who has authoritatively demonstrated that that verse meant left and right, they have spread, was talking about the observance of the Sabbath day itself. Left and right, Sunday and Friday, Christianity and Islam spread, missed Shabbos just slightly, each by a day, Friday and Sunday respectively. Yet Hashem Taritzi, but in the end, Messianic Sabbath, they'll observe the Jewish Sabbath, which is right in the middle, is the authoritative understanding of that verse, according to Rabbi Professor Kimmelman. People know Reuven Kimmelman? Yeah, he's a special teacher. So anyway, so this Zohar idea is kind of there. And then her left wing or two other parties branching off for two other nations, namely Ammon and Moab, which are the two that are not allowed to convert at the beginning, but then at a certain generation are allowed to convert. There's like restrictions which are lifted. All of them are called souls of the living being. So those people, when they convert, Christians and Muslims are nefesh chaya. Like they go all the way up. They have special status as converts. So the Zohar thing isn't Jew versus Gentile. There's like a hierarchy within Gentiles where certain Gentiles are basically Jews, lost Jews. The Ari will get into this in a much more convoluted or detailed way, and we'll conclude here or pick this up next time, but that certain Gentiles, if they come to convert, are really coming back and are actually Jewish, and we actually therefore probably kind of want them to convert. This is a kind of different idea of proactive conversion of Muslims and Christians and Ammonites and Moabites for that matter. Okay, so to be continued, the eighth commandment and then the ninth next time about loving the poor. You'll see how we'll immediately go from here to poverty and wealth, capitalism and socialism, and the right economic system. So we're just going to keep going with our preemptory mitzvot. Next week, I had on the schedule we're going to take 2 weeks off, but I think we will do that. You know what? I could do it next week if people are people around next week. Let's do next week, but the week after we'll take off. All right. I know there's a kind of hard abrupt stop. But thank you, everyone, for what I hope is another interesting exploration into the Zohar, which never disappoints.
Yashikoah.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you all.